Greetings, Merry Christmas, and welcome to installment number 4 of On the Brink with Jeff Wefferson. I hope everyone's had a Merry Christmas. Here in Australia, it's Christmas Day, and I believe when this show is being aired in America, it's now Christmas Day as well. The main theme of this show is something that I thought would be appropriate since it's Christmas, and maybe it's just my own bias, but to me, the real spirit of Christmas has always been about giving. You know, you've got the overt thing of Christmas presents and under the Christmas tree and stuff like that, but in my life and in my mind, the spirit of Christmas has always been about the spirit of giving. And of course, you know, you can talk about the religious aspect and the pagan aspect, where it's the birth of Jesus is quite similar to the winter or summer solstice, depending on the hemisphere that you live in. But the whole idea of giving has, to me, seemed to be what the spirit of Christmas has traditionally been all about. And even if it's just the obsession with people having to run out and buy a bunch of presents so that they can give gifts to people that they think they need to give gifts to, that's sort of a superfluous, more material manifestation of the idea of giving. But it's still about giving. But what I want to talk about is sort of a larger, more spiritual, philosophical, basic, fundamental orientation in our mentality of giving. But before I do that, I'll contrast the spirit of giving with the spirit of getting or taking, which is related to the whole thing of greed. It's really sort of probably the single most fundamental underlying attitude or premise of a capitalistic society based on money and the selling of goods and the commodification of resources and people. And in addition to the spirit of giving, I'll also talk about having a sense of gratitude, a sense of being thankful for everything that we've all been blessed with. Even those of us who think that they're in dire circumstances, and in many ways we all are, for anybody that cares to be truly awake and really go to the effort to be aware of what's really going on in the world behind the scenes and in full view that we don't want to pay attention to, we're all in dire straits. And like I said in my email posting today, which was a Merry Christmas from here in Western Victoria, honest to God, I don't know how long any of us have, because it seems like the vast majority of people are just wandering around in this sort of daydream of they think everything's A-okay. But it's not. How could it possibly be? The earth and all our fellow life forms are basically screaming out at us on frequencies or wavelengths that we can't really hear, because we're deaf and dumb to them. We're blinded to them. We become desensitized because of the artificial synthetic environments that we live in, and the artificial and powerfully destructive energies and emanations that we are constantly surrounded by with in these artificial environments, like the noise and the electromagnetic radiation from the TV and the microwaves and the mobile phones and Wi-Fi and all this stuff. So it's really hard for me to imagine how anyone can think that everything is A-okay and just go about trying to live their life the same way that they would 10 or 20 years ago. But this is not the world of 10 or 20 years ago, and that's extremely important to realize in the sort of the matrix of the modern day mindset based on mass media and what people see on TV and read in the newspaper and talk about on radio shows and stuff, not on UCY TV of course, but on mainstream radio. People would think that there's absolutely nothing that anyone needs to be concerned or worried about, and that they just continue along with their business as usual. And the main thing that consists of in this society is looking out for number one. So who is number one? This may be one of the keys to understanding a difference in the basic mentality of sort of indigenous societies or cultures versus the modern mainstream industrialized civilized mentality. Number one, and again, this is a generalization and the reality is going to be more complex, but I believe that in indigenous societies, number one was actually the whole group or society as one unified and integrated community of people that knew and loved and cared about each other. Number one was equally shared between the priority of your own individual self and the importance or significance of all the other individuals that were in your community and family group and tribe. Whereas in the modern Western industrialized mindset, number one is me. Like there was this character on the original Saturday Night Live named Al Franken, and he was always talking about, yes, this is about me, Al Franken. It was quite funny. But that sort of summarized the whole me generation kind of thing, where everybody is looking out for number one. And so when you think about it, how many of the decisions that we make on a day-to-day basis are made within the basic reference frame that looking out for number one, that is, i.e., for you yourself as an isolated ego or individual person, that your decision making is, it's a given that any decision you make is going to be based on benefiting you versus benefiting somebody else or other beings or the earth. I think if we stop and analyze a lot of the behavior of people in today's society, a big part of it is about people are out there getting. They're getting stuff. They're getting things done. They're getting things for themselves or obtaining things or even stealing things or conducting business arrangements that are based on getting more money, getting more clients, getting more resources. A lot of the sort of, I don't really want to use the word war because it's too mild of a term, but most of the sort of military aggression that we're seeing in the world today is also based on getting. It's based on, and not just getting, like the violent taking of lands, resources, taking the lives of people and other beings all over the planet. So the reason I'm bringing all this stuff up is that so all this stuff is the antithesis of giving. I'm describing the dominant mentality of our civilization because so much of it is, it's not about giving, it's about getting and taking and stealing and robbing and raping and pillaging, but it's all a form of like, it's the opposite of giving in both physical action and in intent. So I've spoken before in some of these interviews I've done with Mr. X on Night Watch and with Christine Consolo on Nuked Radio and talking with Peter Eyre about how when we look at some of the most basic problems of our society, it all goes back to our violation of one of the most fundamental warnings that we've ever been given by indigenous people, and it's part of the Hopi prophecy, and it's the one that says, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. So it's my premise. I keep returning to this prophecy in almost every talk that I do because it's so central to what's happening in the world right now. But because of our greed for resources from the earth, instead of being happy and satisfied to just live in a simple, harmonious way that provided everything that we needed to be fully human. For example, the way that the traditional indigenous people of Australia have lived for 100,000 years or more. Our mentality terms them primitive. The British explorers, when they came to Australia, they called it terra nullius, which means a land of nothing, of no one, even though there was a large population of indigenous people, but because they didn't have much clothes on, they didn't have tools, they didn't live in apartment buildings and have firearms and work with metal and stuff, they classified these as subhuman beings instead of probably the most spiritually advanced race of humans that's existed since the Neanderthals. And yes, you should check out a book called The Singing Neanderthals by Stephen Mithin, because it's really incorrect for us to use the term Neanderthal to describe someone that's barbarian and violent and stuff, because from what he believes, that the Neanderthals were not like that at all. They were probably much more close to being truly human than Homo sapiens. But that's another story. I'll just elaborate on the Hopi prophecy of, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster, for anybody who might be listening that's not familiar with the basic idea. The Hopis are an extremely traditionally peaceful Native American tribe living in Arizona, and they've lived on these isolated mesas way up high, never really engaged in warfare or fought with other tribes or among themselves. I think the name Hopi actually means people of peace. So they've got these prophecies that were passed down for thousands of years orally. They were brilliantly portrayed in a film called Koyaanisqatsi, which is a Hopi Indian word that means life out of balance or crazy life, a way of life that requires a new way of living. This film came out in 1985, made by cinematographer Ron Fricke, and with the soundtrack done by the Philip Glass Ensemble. I was lucky enough to actually see a live performance of this in Melbourne back in, I guess it was August or September. Philip Glass Ensemble performed live at the Art Center. They showed the movie on full-size screen behind the live performance. It was pretty intense. But so anyway, Koyaanisqatsi is a word from the Hopi language that describes exactly what we're seeing in the world now. And it's not something that just happens by chance. It's something that happens because the people progressively choose to live in increasingly disharmonious ways, out of balance with a true path that the Great Spirit laid down. Now, it's possible that there could be sort of an underlying causes for this in terms of varying cosmic influences or energies impinging on the earth that may sort of be the energetic mechanism behind the galactic seasons that we call the yugas, which I talked about a little bit in the last show, which are sort of seasons of a galactic year of varying lengths, and they may not each have a specific length, like sort of we divide winter, spring, fall, and summer into four equal divisions of a year. The yugas may each have a different length, and they may be measured not so much by an astronomical period of time, but by just when the energy changes. And this reminds me of something that I meant to bring up in the last show, but I forgot about I've read that, I believe it was in a Jose Arguez or Carl Kalman book, that part of the Mayans' reckoning of time was not purely astronomical in the sense of, oh, well, okay, now we're in the period of this because this star is aligned with this, galaxy, or here now the sunrise is coming through these mountaintops, or things like that are basically geometrical and physical, but that they had an aspect or possibly a whole calendar based on the reckoning of a form of qualitative time based on the type of energy or emanations coming out from the Hunab-Q, which is the center of the galaxy. So they would have X number of hundreds or thousands of years when this was the time of Hupli-Dupli-Quetzal broadcasting this particular type of archetype or energy. And then it would sort of more or less shift, I'm not sure how quickly, into a different sort of archetype energy of the Hupli-Dupli-Quetzal energy. And these, there was, I think, 16 or 17 of these, and they sort of oscillated back and forth, like one was a day, one was a night, one was a day, one was a night, but they gave them names as if they were beings. So in other words, instead of having winter, spring, fall, and summer, you'd have varying seasons of a large cycle that were based on the qualities of beings. And this actually reminds me quite a bit of the Dreamtime ancestors of the indigenous Australian people, who were not reckoned as forces of nature like gravity or electromagnetism or strong and weak nuclear, or in fact gravity, that sort of impersonally somehow were involved in the creation of all these bodies and forces, but that there were actually beings with anthropomorphic attributes like creativity, decision making, all the full spectrum of stuff that people do, like in Shakespeare, like lust, treachery, honor, nobility, bravery, cowardice, everything. The whole gamut was there. Again, this is an interesting way of looking at a non-scientific, quote-unquote, in terms of Western science, a non-scientific approach to understanding large-scale sort of cosmic processes that are going on, whether you're talking about the creation of the earth and the land and the history of life, or the ongoing energetic emanations that influence what's happening on this planet. During the past 5,000 years, which is a sort of what we reckon is the beginning of history, it's about as far back as we can see in terms of there being any, not only written records, but sort of artifacts like temples and archaeological ruins and stuff like that that bear witness to these ancient civilizations and stuff like that. But pretty much throughout this whole era that we call history, it's all been based on getting or taking from the land, digging precious things from the land, like first digging out the granite and the stone, then your coal, your petroleum, your uranium, your gold. Gold's been dug out for a long time. And if you just look at the total amount of socio-cultural destruction and damage and killing and ecocide, genocide, everything bad you can think of that's been motivated by the greed for these resources that are literally dug or drained or pumped out of the earth. This is sort of like the foundation of greed in itself. But when did anyone ever give anything back to the earth? And so now we're getting to sort of what the show is all really about. What does it really mean to give? A gift implies that it's free, that it was given unconditionally, that it wasn't something that was sold or that you had to like make a bargain for it or make a deal. A gift is something that you've either someone or something gave it to you, or that you've always had, but you never had to do anything for it. Fundamentally, every single one of us is here. I mean, think of how profound this is. Every person on this planet, every life form, every being, everything on this whole planet is here only because of Mother Earth gifting our existence to us. And I think this is so fundamental of a thing to realize, it can actually blow you away when you actually sit and think about this. The Mother Earth as a planet, a planetary being, Gaia, a superorganism, an intelligence that we have no comprehension of how vast and beautiful that she really is. We're actually a part of her. We're her children. And she has given us, she has given birth. Now that's an interesting expression, to give birth to something. So birth of a newborn being, whether it's an animal, a plant, of whatever level, birth is sort of like one of the most fundamentally symbolic gifts, because you give birth, you don't take birth. Birth is given unconditionally, and it's like a child doesn't make a deal with its mom that or broker its birth from the mother so that it can pave its way more harmoniously into this world. No, a being is brought into this world unconditionally through love, hopefully. Traditionally, that's how it was. And I believe that Mother Earth has given birth to all the life forms who now grace this planet and whoever have in the past through an unconditional act of giving, of love, of sharing her energy and her body with us. and combine with them the energy and the animating force of the sun, also known as Ahu to the Mayans, and the energies from the Hunabku and other different beings and forces that are constantly playing a part in this whole cosmic process. But we're all here as gifts from Mother Earth. But how many of us have ever paid anything back to Mother Earth or offered to give anything back? I mean, of course, when we leave this body, undergo the process that we have somehow come to refer to as death, although I think that the ancient Egyptians had a much better way of describing it. Their description for what we call death was actually coming forth by day. This was explained to me by my friend Moira Timms, author of a really brilliant book called Beyond Prophecies and Predictions, which I highly recommend that you get a copy of if you can find it. You could probably order one from Amazon. But she was decades ahead in terms of mapping out the whole thing with Earth changes and all the sort of different multicultural influence in terms of an understanding of where we are now in space, time, and history of ancient cosmological understanding of universal processes. She helped me a lot with Egyptian hieroglyphics that I've used in my artwork, CD titles, and stuff like that. But she explained to me that the Egyptians, that coming forth by day was actually their what they called death. And to them, it wasn't something to be afraid of. Like in our society, our fear of death, that people, it's lurking there in their mind, but they never think about it. But it's a driving force behind a lot of our obsession with materialism. Maybe a lot of our getting and a lot of our stealing and raping of the earth. But anyway, coming forth by day was actually when we really woke up. It wasn't like an end to anything. But like people in today's world, they go like death. Oh yeah, that's when it's all over. You go like, no. To the ancient Egyptians, coming forth by day, that was when you actually woke up from the dream that is the netherworld of the world that we live in now. You woke up into the true, eternal, bright reality, but the very first thing that happened was that you were held accountable for everything that you did or didn't do in this life. And that's sort of a phenomenon that's talked about in other different spiritual traditions like Christianity and Tibetan Buddhism. So there could be something to it that it lends credence to the whole belief that there is an inherent responsibility that we have in terms of our being here as spiritual beings endowed with free will and an immense amount of creativity. And we've all pretty much been shown or given opportunities to know or understand the paths that we're really supposed to live on. But the measure of that is how well that we've actually done that in our life. So anyway, I'm sort of deviating from the point here, but again, so much of our whole mentality has deviated from what I believe is the true path of giving and sharing and gratitude that defines our true nature as human beings. And we've sort of fallen or descended into a debased, degraded mentality that's so widespread that it's now normal of being implicitly greedy, of always looking out for number one, of letting that attitude influence every decision that you make and your whole framework of values and the whole idea of getting more and more takes precedence over any conception of giving or sharing. I think in my own personal life, this is one of the biggest differences that I've always felt between myself and sort of the majority of people. And again, it's a generalization. And again, I'm not really talking to my circle of close friends and people that I know, but sort of like a lot of mentalities that you encounter, the mentality that you encounter in the world at large, mass media, the characters portrayed on TV, and things like that. I've always been a very giving person. I mean, it's always, it just, it's not like I set out to go like, oh, I want to be a giving person. It just seemed like to be my nature to want to give and share as much as possible with everyone. And it's brought me into conflict with people and mentalities a lot of times, because a lot of this relates to this fictional creation that's worshipped as God by a lot of people in this society called money. Now, this is a really interesting and scary phenomenon that we have. It's sort of like this occult influence that we live under, because when you think about it, the whole concept of money and capitalism is directly related to what we're talking about, the whole mentality of giving and sharing versus taking and greed and hoarding and stealing. So, and it all goes back to digging precious things from the land and the whole thing with gold, which I still don't really understand what the inherent obsession with gold is in the human psyche, and not all humans, but a lot of the Western mentality, the Spanish who came to the Americas and murdered like 100 million Native Americans because of their desire to get their gold and stuff like that. Anyway, in my own life, it's always seemed like I've never been interested in getting very much at all. I've always had sort of a hard time dealing with the money thing, because I've always sort of seen it for what it is. It's this fiction. I mean, even in the beginning, I knew there was something really bogus about it, but then only many years later did I actually do the research and educate myself to understand where it all came from. But indigenous people didn't use money. They lived in communities and tribal groups and families where the people knew each other. But not only did they know each other, they actually loved and cared for each other. So there was no need for money. There was no need for even bartering. I mean, maybe between different tribes and stuff. But I think, and again, this may be an idealized overgeneralization, but I think that there is some truth and credibility to it, that the indigenous mentality is not so concerned with looking out for number one and getting. They sort of naturally share everything they have with others, because they're more concerned about everybody having what they need than they are about themselves getting way more than they need. And so if you look at one of the big things that's out of balance with our society, you've got so many people, the more dominant, ruthless mentalities that have acquired positions of power and wealth of finances and stuff like that. And the main thing they do is try to dominate and control the other people who don't share that same mentality. And the main thing they do is get all this stuff for themselves. I mean, every person in the world that's rich in terms of money, how the fuck did they get rich except by taking it from other people? Or they set it as a top priority to, quote unquote, get rich. We've got to get rich at all costs. We've got to get all that money and get all that stuff, dig out all those resources from the earth, kill all these people that are in our way, enslave all these people. We've got to get all this shit and make it mine and get on top of that heap and pound my chest. It's a word for that. It's called brachiating. But so it's really bizarre when you think about it, the whole thing of capitalism, the whole existence of money. I've said before many times that money is capitalism is not like a religion. It is a religion. It has every single salient characteristic of any mainstream religion, but the one it's lacking is that which makes it far more dangerous, the fact that it is not recognized as such. It is not recognized as a religion. So therefore, it's just like in the same way that alcohol is not recognized as a drug and it's legal. It's therefore probably the most destructive chemical substance in our society, you know, probably even worse than fluoride or mercury. Alcohol, in terms of people, what people do under its influence and how much they destroy their own mental and psychological and spiritual health, how much violence occurs and traffic accidents occur because of alcohol. Same thing because of money. It's like a an insidious drug, it's also a complete hallucination that's been foisted on us. And it's all based on getting. So, because people have to get money, and it's really unusual for somebody to give money to somebody unless they've got so much that they're actually making money by giving money, which I think that's sort of what the large scale philanthropic thing is all about. It's really just a scam because they're not really given anything. They're basically, they're maybe giving some just so that it keeps the rest of it from being taken. But it's all the stupid hallucination of the human mind. The whole thing of money and all this stuff has nothing to do with the earth or any other species of life except for us. Mother Earth has given birth to all of us, every living being, every human being, every person, including Ray Kurzweil. Even the nanotechnology that he's transforming into is still, believe it or not, made from the body of Mother Earth. I mean, they've mutated it and transformed it in so many ways, and it's probably completely, well, it's probably like a tumor. Like all this synthetic stuff, it's probably very similar to cancer cells in our body, because it's stuff that doesn't belong. It's not really alive. It doesn't really fit. It doesn't really have a healthy purpose. And so basically, pretty much all of industrial civilization could probably be looked at as a tumor on the earth. But yeah, this is another topic for another show. I've said before in some of my other interviews and writings that I think that there's nothing wrong with our biology as human beings. We're actually an extremely brilliantly designed, extremely sophisticated cybernetic biotechnology. In the true etymological senses of these words, there's nothing wrong with our biology. In fact, very much the opposite. We're not only human beings, but every other living thing is so brilliantly and perfectly designed. And I use the term design because I do think that there is a consciousness behind it, but it's not any consciousness that we can comprehend. And yet, I'm not necessarily talking about quote-unquote God or what they call intelligent design, nothing like that. But there is a beauty and a power. And when you look at the what I call the ultimate technology, which is my basic concept for what we are as human beings in terms of all the amazingly complex internal workings of our whole organism, our whole psyche, all the different abilities and processes that we use and that we're using every second to do all the amazing things that we're doing, infinitely more complex than a car. Yet how many people can get in a car and drive it successfully without having any idea of how it works? That's almost everybody. And the same with us. We're each inhabiting this brilliant piece of, it's like a sacred temple of the ultimate technology, a human being. And each of us has that, more or less, especially if we haven't gone too far out of bounds to destroy ourselves or to make ourselves sick or unhealthy. We're each able to inhabit a human vehicle, and we've got an immense amount of freedom. We've got creativity. We've got the ability to perceive, remember, think, and communicate, model reality, and share our beliefs, and to try to understand the big picture of what it means to be here now as human beings on Mothership Earth. We've got all this for free as a gift. But how thankful are we for it? No, we're not thankful at all. All we can do is think about getting more stupid stuff, more money, more bullshit from the shopping mall, more real estate, more houses to live in, more cars, more TVs, more mobile phones. So, in other words, what I'm talking about, it's a dysfunctional mentality that we've collectively created and allowed to come into being in our dominant psyche over the past 5,000 years. Again, like I said, the problem is not in our biology, it's in our software. The problem is in what I call the sort of summation of our collective set of beliefs and attitudes, metaprograms, if you will, in terms of, that's what Dr. John Lilly would like to call it. I call it our distributed mental operating environment. It's the basic cognitive paradigm of our whole, the group psychology of humanity. And again, this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the specific language you speak. Pretty much the whole idea of capitalism and Hollywood and all these basic worldviews have been foisted on people all around the world and translated all these different languages. So it's really become, it's a series of beliefs and images and values that have transcended any specific culture or language. That this has sort of become the new synthetic, unified New World Order culture of materialism and products and attitudes of getting and looking out for number one, of doing anything is okay to get on top of the heap. There's no sense of morals, ethics, or values anymore. It's okay to stab your brother in the back to get ahead. It's okay to lie, cheat, and steal. It's okay to conduct organized crime while you're a member of public office under oath. All these things are sort of taken as normal now, and no one questions whether it's even bad. So again, we come back to the whole point of that Mother Earth has basically given us our existence. But how thankful for it are we? I think that a really important thing that each of us can do in general is to step back out of the rat race of daily life and reflect on exactly what it is that drives you to do what you do. To look at your most basic assumptions, your most fundamental motivations that define your frame of reference and your sense of values that gives meaning to your life. And go, well, how many of these driving motivations and forces in my life are based on getting something versus how many of these are based on giving? And I think if most people look at their daily decision making, they'll find that the vast majority of decisions that we make are based on getting, obtaining stuff rather than giving. And this is sort of the focus of this whole show, for me to point out that each of us, using our immense creativity and our ability for self-awareness that's our own birthright as human beings, we've got the ability to step back. And not just the ability, I think that we're each being urgently called on by the cosmos, the Great Spirit, and Mother Earth right now to ask more of ourself in every way, but beginning by using our powers of self-analysis and introspection to look, examine our own decision-making and to go, well, you know, how much am I really all about getting and taking versus how much of me is all about giving and sharing and being thankful? So what I'm talking about here is the ability that we have to reprogram our unquestioned assumptions that, taken as a whole, create the whole interconnected system of beliefs, thoughts, attitudes, and assumptions that define the distributed mental operating environment that's allowing us to go around raping the earth, sitting in silence watching TV while the military of our country goes and blows up innocent civilians in another country just so that the oil companies who control the military can get their oil. And whales and dolphins are blasted to death by one blast of military sonar or seismic testing, but hey, that's just, you know, it's a shame, isn't it? And environmental organizations are taking in tens or hundreds of millions of dollars every year, but they never even mention these things. Just so many atrocities in the world, but yet we fail to be concerned with it because we're too concerned with looking out for number one. Now, if something happens that influences your ability to get all your shit, like if something interferes with your income or something interferes with your ability to get your new car or to get your new house or to get your new holiday or anything like that, now, then people are going to get pissed off. Do you know anyone who ever paid any rent to the earth? I can't think of anybody. I can't think of anybody that ever offered to actually ask a whale or dolphin if they minded being recorded either. They just sort of like assume that it's okay, and they get and take these recordings of whales and dolphins, and they sell them for a lot of money. All these documentaries on TV, National Geographic, IMAX, and then they won't let anybody else use it without charging them a lot of money. But did the whales or dolphins get anything? No. Did Mother Earth ever receive a cent of rent from anybody, any human being? I don't think so. And sure, this led me to the thing of talking about what we call death, or as the Egyptians called it, coming forth by day. We all return our matter that our body has been constructed of. It returns to the earth when our spirit leaves this body. But in fact, we were always here. We've never left the earth. So that's kind of like another thing to talk about for a different show. I think what I really wanted to focus on is the necessity of each of us examining the unquestioned assumptions that drive our daily lives, our daily decision-making, and look and see how much of it is based on getting and taking versus how much of it is based on giving and sharing. So we've all got the ability to change anything that we want to change about ourselves, or anything we want to become that's different. Within certain limits, we've got the ability to do that. So if you're constantly analyzing everything that you're doing, which is actually a very good idea, although it takes a little bit of work, it can actually be scary sometimes. If you look, any time that you're going to make a decision during the day, and consider whether it involves getting something or giving something, just look at the overall balance of how many of these decisions there are that involve getting and how many involve giving. And then you can make a conscious effort to shift that balance towards having more events that involve giving and sharing, and fewer events that involve getting or taking. And it's possible to eventually get to a point where you might be able to do nothing except for give and share, because, now here's where the miracles would come into play. If you're surrounded by enough people operating on a similar wavelength, if you're surrounded by a whole group or a family or community or tribe of people who are all doing nothing but giving and sharing, then everybody's going to be giving and sharing so much with each other that no one's going to need to get or take anything, because they're already going to have everything they need. And this right here is the whole key to how we can put the whole international banking community out of existence and get rid of this diabolical occult delusion called money, that's like this. It's a form of spiritual cancer that's allowing us to destroy our own lives and Mother Earth and the lives of our fellow beings because of our greed for money, which is really nothing. We'll do anything. So if we determined to change our lives so that almost everything we did involved giving or sharing rather than taking or getting, we'd be able to transform human social reality into a world that we wouldn't even recognize anymore, because we wouldn't need banks. We wouldn't be worried about people stealing from each other. And again, this might sound sort of like a grandiose, idealistic dream. But think about it. In terms of your daily life, if everybody just gave more and took less, the world would be a different place. And related to the whole concept of giving is also the whole concept of gratitude, or being thankful. Because how many people do you know that in terms of even just the material world, they've got everything you can imagine and more, even more than you can imagine? So many people are at that level, and yet they're not happy. And how many of these people that have all this stuff are actually thankful? Not many at all, because all they can worry about is how they're going to get more. They've got to get a new one of this, a new one of that, a bigger one of this, a bigger one of that, more of these, more of those. There's no end to it with this whole... it's a mentality. This mentality actually was given a name by psychologist Stanislav Grof. He calls it the hylotropic mentality, that where they can people can never get enough, because it's not about how much you've got, it's about the whole act of getting more. And again, a lot of psychologists have looked into this kind of thing. Eric Fromm, with his description of what he calls the marketing character as a form of necrophilia. Stan Grof with the hylotropic thing. It's all been looked at quite a lot. But the bottom line is, you don't really need to look anywhere outside of your own day-to-day life to see how much giving and taking that you do, and how much thankfulness that we each have in our daily lives. I sort of went to the trouble of giving a name to this distributed mental operating environment that's based on greed and taking, and I call it Wasichu. Wasichu is a name from the Lakota Native Americans. I read it in a book called Black Elk Speaks, where the Black Elk was a Native American medicine man from the Lakota tribe of the Dakotas in the late 1800s, and an author sort of wrote down what Black Elk told him and the story of his life, and it's become this pretty famous book that's been around for several decades. I've read it two or three times, and it's very powerful. It's very sad because Black Elk witnesses his whole people being decimated by the white man as they come and lie and steal and take everything. So the name Wasichu, Wasichu, that was the Lakota name for the white man. And what it means is, literally, he who takes the fat. Because the fat was the most prized and valuable part of the buffalo, I think they probably ate the meat and used the hides, but the fat probably was the most, had the highest energy content, and they used it for many different things. So it was the part that was the most valuable part was the fat. So the Lakota Native Americans watched the white man come and kill all the buffalo and took all the fat and just left the rest of the buffalo laying there. And they took way more than they needed, and they killed them all and just left it all laying there. And this horrified and shocked them beyond belief. And so that became their name for the white man, Wasichu, he who takes the fat. And it's basically a name based on a blatant behavior of both greed and killing. So it's a very appropriate name for this distributed mental operating environment, Wasichu. So we each have to look at ourselves and go, how much of a Wasichu are we? I think that every time you turn on a television or read a newspaper, pretty much every character or personality described or depicted, or every sort of story that's going on, every play that's being enacted, just about everything in movies and mass media today is nothing but the story of Wasichu. But not everybody is Wasichu. There's different, you know, what Wasichu qualities that depend on different kinds of decisions and stuff like that. Again, it's more, the reality is more complex than just a few words, and nothing's black and white. There's many shades of gray in between. But in contrast with the greedy Wasichu mentality, which is the dominant mentality of the leaders and the New World Order CEOs and executives of all these big corporations and think tanks and transnational entities that want to take over the earth and depopulate the earth and microchip everybody and rule as overlords of creation. In contrast with Wasichu, you've got what the Hopi also described as the people of one heart. The people of one heart are in a minority, but they're the sort of milder, humbler people that aren't out there looking out for number one. They aren't trying to get on top of the heap. They aren't living by unquestioned or unconsciously enacted Wasichu drives and motivations. The people of one heart are the real people who actually are still living on the path that the Great Spirit laid down for us, where we're supposed to love and care for one another and share and live by giving and to live simply so that others may simply live. This is what the people of One Heart are all about. And the Hopi prophecy said that when the day of purification comes near, which we're certainly getting pretty close to it now, we might actually be in the day of purification, the people of One Heart will somehow be able to find each other, and they'll be able to be in the right place at the right time because their crown chakra will remain open. It won't be shut down. They'll be able to always hear and respond to the highest spiritual guidance coming from the Great Spirit. And they'll always be able to find each other and help each other out. And they're not worried about getting money from each other. And they're not worried about getting on top of the heap. But the people of One Heart are the people who live by giving and sharing, and they're constantly giving thanks for the abundance that we all have, and living in a state of perpetual gratitude for the gift of life from the Great Spirit and Mother Earth, and the beauty of the world of nature that we live in, and the beauty of our friends, the beauty of the improbable design of the universe, and the amazing cybernetic biotechnology in the true etymological sense that each of us is, that every living being is, the amazing intelligence of every living being. If you wanted to catalog all the things that we have to be thankful for, I could probably talk for several hours. But I ask you now to stop and think, or better yet, grab a pen and a piece of paper and just start writing down how many things that you have to be thankful for. I think if all of us made first a major effort to just bring it into your conscious day-to-day radar, the things that I'm talking about here, and constantly look at your decision making and just go think of how much of our lives are about giving and sharing, and how much of them are about taking and getting. I think that just that awareness alone will inspire all of us to go like, well, you know, what have I really become? How much have I been influenced by the paradigm of mass media, the Wasichi mentality that sort of crept into everything? Because is that really why we're here as fellow beings? Are we really here to take and steal and rob from each other and from Mother Earth? And how can we change our ideas and our beliefs and attitudes and therefore our actions and behavior in a way that reflects giving and sharing and gratitude and has less of the taking and giving and raping and pillaging? Because, for example, the whole mining industry is all about, it's just running out of control here in Australia. I'm sad to say that Environmental Minister Tony Burke, whose job should really be called the Ministry of Extraction, has just given the green light for open-cut coal mines in the Tarkine, which is one of Tasmania's most undisrupted wilderness areas. It's on the west coast. And I just found this out. A company called Venture Mining has just been granted leases to do open-cut coal mines and also mine for iron compounds like hematite and magnetite. And this is beyond belief. Also, this administration is allowing dredging of the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area off of Gladstone to make way for channels for these supertankers carrying gas. Same with James Price Point near Broome, where they're going to dredge in a humpback whale nursery to make room for these supertankers carrying gas to come and go. This is atrocities beyond belief, and it's all based on the greed for resources, digging precious things from the land, about getting and taking. And so if all of us were actually really thankful for what we have, we'd realize that there's we don't need any more of these mines and this dredging to be going on. If we all generated a wave of giving and sharing and gratitude based on not just our thoughts but our actions, and became more people of One Heart who love Mother Earth and live simply so that others may simply live, if enough people actually made a conscious shift in their day-to-day life to become people of one heart and less Wasichu, then the Wasichu mentality could theoretically dry up and cease to exist. But we've got a long way to go before that can happen. Jesus said, it is written in the Bible somewhere, that it is more blessed to give than to receive. And I think this is really true. I think if all of us made serious efforts to give as much as possible in every way, that'll be in honor of the gift of life that we've been given by Mother Earth and the Great Spirit, which none of us paid for, none of us paid to be born, none of us has ever paid any rent to the earth. So this is a call from me and from the Great Spirit and the heart of Mother Earth to everyone on this whole planet to wake up. And in the words of George Carlin, the philosopher-comedian, ask more of yourself. Think of all that we have to be thankful for. Think of how many people in the world, 1.5 billion people in the world, don't even have access to clean drinking water. Untold billions don't have food. When I see people posting images on Facebook of food and drink and stuff, I instantly comment with articles about this because it's sickening to me. That mentality, the Wasichu mentality, is rampant on Facebook. But we've each got a choice of who and what we want to be. Think of how much you've got to be thankful for. We've also can be thankful that, at least for now, air and gravity are still free. We have to pay for petroleum and electricity, but we've got a lot of free things to think about. I'd like to thank all of my friends and family and ancestors, my mom and dad in heaven, my ancestors on this planet and other planets. I'd like to thank Mother Earth and Father Sky and the UNFQ and all the beings, the whales and dolphins. I'd like to thank my partner, Lisbeth Verstraten, who's down in Tasmania now, for 5 years of the most wonderful journey together that any two human beings could have on this planet. And I look forward to doing more creative work with you someday. I'd better say goodbye for now. Thank you for listening to On the Brink with Jeff Wefferson. And tune in next week and have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.